I kind of like preaching from down here on occasion for a couple reasons. Sometimes, like I mentioned this morning, with moving you closer, until you've actually preached and taught, you don't realize how difficult it is to preach when there's a distance separating you. It's very difficult for the pastor to do that. If it's easy for the pastor to do that, then the message is not going to be very helpful to you. You really depend upon the fact that what we're doing here, we're doing together. It's not just somebody talking and somebody listening. It's all of us looking into the Word and trying to see what the Lord might say. As you turn to the Gospel of John in chapter 7 tonight, that's especially true because something we're going to talk about tonight, I have a tremendous concern in this area, and especially in regular Baptist circles. One of the greatest problems in any movement is keeping a balance. It's so hard to find yourself in a place where you have both sides of the coin, and in the area of our worship and our walk with the Lord, there are two things that we need. I don't care how you phrase them, but truth and love are probably the easiest two ways to phrase them. You have to have the truth. You've got to be straight. You've got to be committed to the truth. You don't violate the truth for the sake of love. But you also have to have love. It has to be what permeates your relationship to one another. It's got to be evidently visible. When people walked into the service tonight, would they have sensed love? I don't mean that they wouldn't have, but that's not the point. The point is how we were acting and how we were carrying on our service, what would people have sensed? Would they have sensed that we love one another, we love the Lord? If they don't sense that, there's something wrong with our service. The truth can be there, but if there's not love that is overgirding it and surrounding it, then the truth is of no value. And I really believe that... And this sounds strange. I'm on the right wing of regular Baptist circles in my theology. But I think the greatest lack in our circles is love. I really believe it. I really believe that that is something that we've just abandoned, that whole concept, to people who have a doctrine that's not as tight and as strict as ours. And that for the sake of keeping a tight and a strict doctrine, we've allowed ourselves to be loveless and not to concentrate on that. Particularly something I want to talk about tonight, there are some sins I never hear preached about. Sins that you constantly see spoken of and dealt with in the Bible, but you never hear them being emphasized. Tonight I want to talk about prejudice. Today is Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, and it might be an appropriate time to talk about it. I find that regular Baptists are, for the most part, white, middle class Americans. I don't know if you realize that, but that is the fastest shrinking segment of the American population. And if we don't have a gospel that's going to reach across that boundary, then our movement's going to die. We'll become like the Amish, you know, smaller and smaller and smaller. And part of our problem is that we haven't recognized that one of the things that's stopping us from reaching across that boundary is prejudice. It is the hardest thing to convince a person of is that they're prejudiced. We'll see that tonight. It is so hard to convince a person because they don't intend to be. They don't think they are. And yet, I really find that's a terrible problem. Now, you go to our schools. Let me just use BBC since it's a school I went to. You want to find a black, where do you look? Well, probably on a basketball team, right? What do they got, three? At least one of them's on the basketball team. Why doesn't BBC have more blacks? Well, is there some value in having a certain number of African Americans versus no? But the fact that you don't have any year after year after year after year says that our school, my alma mater, that one of the fastest growing segments of the population of America, they're not even touching, they're not even denting. And that's just a paradigm, a small example of what's happening to our movement. And I have a real concern that it's not that they're purposefully being excluded. It's that they're not purposefully being included. You don't need to exclude people. Our doctrine and our ways and our beliefs are tight enough so people aren't going to naturally flock. and say, you know, I want to go to Brookdale. They don't do very much. And the Lord doesn't let them do a lot, so I want to go there. You know, we don't need to worry about excluding people from our church. We're not going to have people flocking to the cause of Christ. People aren't going to look around for the church that observes the Bible the best and come to it. Very few people want that. Well, the problem is we need to recognize and to say, do we have attitudes that we don't know about that are excluding people? And in our personal lives, it's a real concern of mine. As we look at this passage, I want you to see prejudice as it concerned Christ and how the Pharisees acted with prejudice. The Pharisees, their name, P-R-S, our P-H and a P are the same thing in just about any language you want. They're the same letter. One's a soft pronunciation, one's a hard. And the word, anytime you see a word in Hebrew that's got a P, an R, and an S in it, it has to do with the word being separated. Let me go back. Perez. Remember, there were two twins that were born to Judah from his daughter-in-law Tamar, and one, and the name of one was Perez. It means breech birth, a separation. A breech birth is, of course, when the baby is born in the wrong position, and is very, very painful. When the handwriting appeared on the wall, Mene, Tekel, and Perez. You have been separated. You've been divided up, and things have been taken away from you. There are so many, there's a bunch of others, but Pharisee is the same word. They were the separatists. They were started because in the period when the Jews returned back to the land, they found that they had all picked up Babylonian customs, and that the people who were in Palestine and remained there had become basically pagans, had become, we'll talk about them tonight. The people of the land was their name, and they were just a bunch of unidentifiable pagans. They dressed like Jews and looked like Jews, but they lived like pagans. And so the Pharisees started up out of a desire of, let's get pure, let's be separate, let's get back to obeying the Lord's word, and let's get back to the law. Let's start teaching the Bible. We've got to teach these people what it means to be a Jew, because those of us who have returned from Babylon have Babylonian customs. The people who live here don't have it. So the sect of the Pharisees arose during the time when the Greeks were in control of the land exclusively, and different followers of Alexander the Great had four generals who divided up the world between them. And they started to make the whole world think Greek and act Greek. Well, the Pharisees were leaders in the movement to keep from thinking like the Greeks. And the heart of the movement of the Pharisees was separation. Keep your distance. Keep the world at arm's length. Obey the Lord's word and keep people at a distance so we can stay to be Jews. And you see what happens when you do that without love. You get the Pharisees of the New Testament. You get people who are so concerned about being separate, so concerned about being holy, that they've lost love. And when we see them here in John 8, we're seeing sins that were typical of them. You're not going to find Pharisees who are involved with drinking or worldliness or the kinds of sins that sometimes we preach about and that very few people in our churches do. I find that you end up in the pulpit preaching about sins that nobody in your church is doing. You know, we'll preach against cocaine. Well, you might have a person here and there in our churches that are doing it, but usually not. But the sins like gossip, the sins of pettiness, the sins of backbiting, we don't do a lot of preaching on some of those. And as we look at this tonight, I just want you to see prejudice. And it's ugly, and it's rotten. And it's something that you can be prejudiced over race, you can be prejudiced over sex. One of the real problems, again, in our movement, we spent a whole lot of time telling our kids that how bad the women's lib movement is. And it's been pretty terrible. But you know why the women's lib movement is gaining popularity? Because they're talking about real problems and real issues out there. They're addressing things that we ought to be talking about. And yet we don't. There's a lot of inequity and there's a lot of injustice. Face it, men have run the world, and men have run the world for their own good, and that's not right. God hates that. But we don't address that. And so other people and other groups will rise up and address it. And our silence, we attack the groups that address it in the wrong way, instead of saying we better start looking at that and saying that is a problem. That's something that's been going on, and that's something that's horrible. The loudest voice against pornography in America isn't coming from fundamental Christians. It's coming from the women's lib movement. Isn't that sick? Isn't there something wrong there? I think the same thing with prejudice. And I'm going to be dealing tonight a lot with racial prejudice, because that seems to be where our greater problems lie. And I think in our circle, sometimes what we're most blind to, but it has to do with any kind of prejudice in our lives. And we come to John 8. Here's the background. It's the feast of what we call tabernacles. Actually, if you want to use the literal translation, the Jews had a feast called the Feast of Lean-Tos. They would go out in their backyard, and they'd put up a lean-to, and they'd spend a week, and every night they'd sleep in the lean-to. Fast during the day, and then at night they would sleep in the lean-to. The reason for that is God says, I want you to remember that you were out in the wilderness, and you lived in temporary dwelling places. And these houses that you have, and all these nice things that you have, I want you to remember there's a time when you didn't have them. Sometimes the King James calls it the Feast of Booths, B-O-O-T-H-S, and we only use those at the fair today. You know, you go to whatever, the booth, and throw a pie at somebody. They're trying to talk me into doing that in Awana, and they haven't succeeded yet. You know, we're Christians. We don't have the Feast of Booths, you know, you understand. We've got to find somebody else to do that. But one of the problems that the Jews, during this time, it became a very political festival. It was not only a feast, it was a time when they thought, hey, God gave us, the Feast of Booths is to remind us that God took us from being a wandering people and made us a nation. He made us a people with our own country. Abraham wasn't a nation. Isaac, Jacob, they didn't have a nation. All they had was a family and a clan. They went to Egypt. They were a Jewish people, but they weren't a nation. And God took us from the wilderness, and he made us a nation, and he gave us a country. And we're finding out in this century that one of the most powerful human emotions is nationalism. The thought, and this is politically oriented, but the thought that we're going to go in there and solve the problems in Bosnia. They're the ones who helped us start World War I. The national fervor in that part of the world and all over the world that communism failed. For two reasons. One, because it's dumb. You know, it just doesn't work. And two, because in the Soviet Union, communism couldn't overcome nationalism. You've got people who hated one another under the same roof, and the national fervor. Well, Israel was being killed by it. And the Feast of Tabernacles turned into a very politically motivated national time. Jesus stood up and tried to preach God, and they didn't understand. A preacher stands up, he becomes very famous, and we'll see what happens here. Notice, Jesus is saying, and I'm going to just read some verses to show you the kinds of things that he was saying and how amazing it is that in the context of this teaching of Jesus, he'd be so subject to prejudice. As Jesus approached it, notice in verse 16, they say, this guy never went to seminary. This guy never studied formally. He's not a member of any sect. How does he know what he's talking about? Jesus said, my doctrine is not mine, but is his that sent me. If any man will do his will, he shall know of the doctrine, whether it be of God or whether I speak of myself. Jesus said, if you want to know if what I am saying comes from God, you don't listen to political parties. You don't follow the party line. You don't go and get an education to teach you what you ought to believe. You walk close to God, and then everybody will be able to judge for themselves. You'll be able to know and make a proper judgment of what's right and what's wrong. Notice in verse 24, judge not according to appearance, but judge the righteous judgment. We'll talk about that maybe a little bit later. Boy, how often do we do that? When we see somebody, we make our decisions upon what we see and not upon what's right and what's wrong. Can you honestly tell me that when you meet somebody who's black, especially up here, there aren't very many people who are black, that doesn't affect your judgment, you don't think of certain things? Ladies, when you meet a black man suddenly, that doesn't startle you more than it would meeting a white man suddenly? What? And these are things that are very hard to root out, by the way. We've grown up with them. And we'll talk about why that is, but what you're doing is you're judging by appearance. There are certain things that we just tend to do when we see somebody who's scruffy for whatever reason. Now, he could be scruffy because he's a multimillionaire who just happened to have to spend the night out in his car, sleeping in his car. But we make a judgment on the way people dress. We make a judgment on a person by what we see on the outside. We make a judgment by what people say and not by what they mean and not by their actions. That's judging according to appearance. And Jesus is standing up in the middle of this festival saying, you got to be righteous. You got to make righteous judgments. And it's in this context that he's hurt so bad and people try to kill him because of prejudice. Notice in verse 25, some of them said, "Is this not he whom they seek to kill?" Everybody knew that the Pharisees wanted to kill Jesus. And they said, "He's standing up in public preaching. Isn't this the one that they're seeking to kill?" Some said, "He speaks boldly." And they said nothing unto him. "Do the rulers indeed know that this is the Christ? Are the people who are the leaders of our movement, do they understand that this is the Christ?" And Jesus is standing up and preaching it in verse 31. And many of the people believed on him and said, "When Christ cometh, will he do more miracles than these that this man has done?" Many Jews were like Jews today. They said that, yeah, he was a great man, but he wasn't the Messiah. He's not the Christ. He's not the one we should be looking for. And their answer was a good one. "When Christ comes, will he do more than this man did?" You know, how can you ignore this man? How can you ignore the miracles? And all the people are talking. And now let's get into the prejudice. And first thing I want to look at, we'll talk about the Pharisees. Look where their prejudice comes from, what motivates it, what causes it, where it starts from. The Pharisees heard that the people murmured such things concerning him. See, the problem is the Pharisees were politically oriented and they felt threatened. Here's a man who's rising up in power. Here's a man who is gaining the ear of the people. In Jesus' day, there were two main political parties. There were the Hellenistic political parties, the Herodians and the Sadducees, and then there were the Pharisees. Okay, the Hellenists, the Pharisees, or the Sadducees, and the Herodians, their power was because they controlled a very few wealthy people, very very few wealthy people, and you control the wealthy, and you've got a lot of power. And they were the ones who had started to act like Greeks and started to pick up the cosmopolitan Greek culture, and that's where the Sadducees got their power. The Pharisees got their power because they supposedly spoke for the people. They were the ones who were out there with the common people, and they were always talking down the Sadducees and the rich. And that's not hard to do, to stir up the poor against the rich. But now, here's somebody coming, and if he had just spoken and was gaining power among the aristocrats, they wouldn't have cared two hoots. But his power is coming from the people. And the people are starting to turn to him instead of turning to them. And they feel threatened. And their base of power and their base of activity is threatened. Now, I find that a lot of prejudice in our country and in our circles is motivated by people who feel threatened. I never heard Baptists talk about discrimination. I never heard messages on discrimination until we started hearing about reverse discrimination. You know, about the fact that people can discriminate against you because you're not a minority. Now, that's true and that's wrong. But what happens more? You know, for every single time that someone like myself, and in a sense, I have been the victim of reverse discrimination. I couldn't get money to go to school and whatnot. My family was as poor as anybody I knew, and yet I couldn't get the money. But for every example like that, there's 10 examples of regular prejudice, of straightforward racial prejudice. And we never emphasize that until it happens to us. People have no problem with what you have and you keeping what you have and living your life. It's when it looks like they're going to have to take it away from you. We've got a Congress now that's being torn because everybody wants their slice of the pie. Everybody wants to grab a little. Everybody wants to get their fingers in and to say, "This is mine." It was interesting. They have these rotten institution called the talk show on television, that they drag up the worst thing that we all love to see, and they drag it up and they parade it out front. And the problem with this channel switcher is you can see 11, 12, 20 shows at once if you're good, or really bad. You know, I'm not easily occupied, so I like to watch a few things going on, you know, pick up a little here and a little there and like that. So I'm a Renaissance man, what can I tell you? Well, you pet, and this lady stand up and she said, "What we're talking about is empowerment." And if you haven't heard that word, go look it up in the dictionary. Thanks, I think I have a basic idea what you mean by empowerment. The concept, though, is that you've got to go out there and grab what's yours and don't let anybody take it away from you. Ladies, our bodies, ourselves. You can't let anybody tell you what to do with your body, and the way you do that is you go out and grab political power and kick anybody out who won't give you what you want. Your minority is being mistreated. Will you go out there and you grab all the power you can get and you get strong enough, like Louis Farrakhan and the black Muslim movement? America does not need weak blacks. America needs strong blacks. We've got to get out there and take power. Well, I tell you something, the black Muslims have done more to get drugs out of the inner city than the United States government has. Sad thing. I don't know if you know that, that if you go down to Washington, D.C., the drug-free streets are the ones that the black Muslims are patrolling. Did any of you know that? That's what the we think of, and you know how they do that, though? It's a power thing. It's power. We've got to take control over our lives and our destiny. I don't care if we've got to take it away from the whites. I don't care if we've got to take it away from the drug pushers. I don't care if we've got to take it away from this. They're taking power. Well, yes, they're getting success very much. When you see a black Muslim meeting, you'll always see six or seven blacks standing behind the man who's speaking, standing up there, very straight, very giving the power look. Because that is the look. We're here for power. We're backing this man up. There's power there. The problem is, that's not how it works. What you get by power, you lose by power. It's righteousness that's God's way. And the black Muslim movement is getting results in limited areas. They certainly are. And yet it's a power thing. But I'll tell you, it works the other way too. We don't notice any of the social issues of our day as fundamentalists until somebody wants to take something away from us, until our rights are taken away. Until it's our money that's being taken away. Until it's our kids that are being discriminated against. And that's pretty sad. I don't find too many of us who are actually working actively for people other than ourselves. Our interests and our concerns are for ourselves. We send our men to Washington because we want them, our local congressmen, to bring money back to our district. Well, that's not the way America's going to grow, with everybody fighting for their piece of the pie. And we have to understand and say, how much am I actively working for someone else? How much do I care? How much is my movement just to get something for myself? It's a strange world we live in. Organizations called the NAACP are power organizations. And I have mixed emotions. On the one hand, I'll tell you, if they didn't exist, whites would have never given any power to blacks. There's no sense of goodness in the heart of men where we would have given voting to people, where we would have given economic rights, where we would still give rights. White, black, brown, by the way, is just as bad a problem as white, black in America. The Hispanic, the Latino, and the African American. Nobody is going to give up what they've got. And so, like it or not, there wouldn't be civil rights in America if there weren't black power movements. But I'll tell you the other thing, any organization that says National Organization for the Advancement of Colored People tells me they're not concerned about me. They're not concerned about my country. They're concerned about themselves. So what do you do? How do you win? Well, what we do is we say, Lord, I want my heart straight before you. I'm not in it for myself and my family and my way. It's not power I want. These people were frightened for their power, loss of power. Jesus had been preaching and preaching and doing miracles and everything was fine until he started to get popular. Hey, I found that's a real popular trend in Baptist circles today. A preacher can do whatever he wants until he starts to get popular, and then you'll find a host of preachers attacking him, a host of attacks upon him for different reasons. Let me mention some names here while we're at it. There's a radio preacher called John MacArthur, and I don't agree with everything he teaches, but then I don't always agree with everything I teach. You know, a couple weeks later, I think, did I say that? Oh, boy. But I'll tell you something. Here was a man who never was attacked until he started to have a nationwide ministry and people started to listen to him. And then he was attacked for anything and everything. And whether or not we agree with a person, you better have a pretty good reason for attacking somebody. What business is it of mine what somebody else teaches? True? If what they're doing is affecting my church, I should say what they're teaching is wrong in here. But what business do I have attacking every preacher who rises up? If he's an apostate, say he's not of our movement, and identify what he's saying wrong. You don't have to attack the person. But so often that what causes a person to be attacked and to be the victim of prejudice is threat. That people feel threatened that he's going to gain the ear of the people that they want to hear. I won't get into the other examples I have that have to do with when human beings don't get along and how they get threatened by other human beings in a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship, for instance. We're talking about that at school. You know, girls get along really, really well until it looks like their boyfriend is interested in the other girl. True? I mean, they get along absolutely great until there's a little bit of interest, until there's a threat that comes in there. But, of course, I'm not going to get into that tonight. And notice, and the Pharisees and the chief priests sent officers to take him. Okay? Then Jesus said unto them, and I'll pass along through this and come down to the next part. On the last day, the great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried, saying, if any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. It was a feast where they were celebrating God taking them from the wilderness into Israel. So one of the things that people would do is they would live in lean-tos. Everybody came to Jerusalem and they would be camped out around it, living in this wilderness-like, remembering the wilderness. Well, one of the things that they would do is they would have a great ceremony where they would draw water from the Gihon spring and pour it out in memory of the fact that God gave them water in the wilderness. And they would pour this water out that came from a living spring to say, this is how God provides. Even in the midst of the wilderness, He provides it. And it's abundant. And again, I don't know if any of you have ever been in desert before, but you just don't appreciate water until you've been in a dry, desiccated environment. And there's something about you. I'd say you can smell water. You really can when you're dried out. I spent 3 days once in the Negev. And I came back, and one evening, I drank 3 gallons of water. When I came back out of there, I had just dried every bit of whatever out of me. And there's water, when you're in the desert, it's a very powerful thing. Well, it's on that day where they're having the last day of the feast, where they have the great torchlit ceremony, and they come down and they draw water from a Gihon spring and pour it out to remember God providing water in the wilderness, that Jesus stood up and said, He, in verse 37, if any man thirst, let him come unto me. Everybody's attention is drawn on the fact that God provided water in the wilderness. And then Jesus said, if you thirst, come unto me. I will meet your needs. I'll provide for what you need. And he's talking about the Holy Spirit. Now notice what the people said. Many of the people, therefore, when they heard this saying, said, of a truth, this is the prophet. Sometime, if you want to write in your Bibles, write Deuteronomy 18 in here. And the Old Testament had prophesied that a great prophet would come, the Messiah as a prophet, in Deuteronomy 18. So many times in the Gospel of John, people would come and say, are you the prophet? That was a question asked in the Gospel of John, chapter 1, of John the Baptist. Are you that prophet? Others said, this must be the Christ. But some said, is Christ going to come from Galilee? The Bible said that Christ was going to come from Bethlehem. This guy comes from Galilee. Okay, hath not the scripture said, Christ cometh out of the seed of David, out of the town of Bethlehem, where David was? So there was a division among the people because of them. Some of them would have taken him, but no man laid hands on him. I tell you, the other really huge factor in prejudice is ignorance. Nobody really knew who Christ was. People had a little bit of the picture on both sides. Some people said the truth. This must be Christ. But they didn't understand how it could be Christ. The other people said it can't be Christ. They knew the truth that Christ would come out of Bethlehem, but they didn't know that Jesus had actually been born in Bethlehem. And so each side has a little piece of the puzzle. Do you see that? The people who said this must be Christ, they had the truth, but they couldn't explain all the facts. This other side, they had some facts. They knew the Bible. I mean, they could read their scriptures and say Christ would come from Bethlehem, from the seed of David, but they didn't. They didn't see that Jesus did meet that. And one reason why prejudice occurs is that you get two groups who each have a piece of the puzzle and can't see what the other side has to say. Both of these groups is right, and there's a division among them. But neither of them has the full story. Now, I think one of the purposes of an education is to give you a few more pieces of the puzzle. We have two of our kids going to a public school, two of our kids going to a Christian school. And so far that's worked out good because I want my kids to see all the pieces of the puzzle. There are things that my kids are never going to learn in a public school. There are pieces to the puzzle they're not going to get. On the other hand, I feel that there are things that my children are seeing in public school, size, things they're being exposed to that a Christian school just isn't big enough to expose them to, science and different kinds of stuff. And what I'm really after is not to find the best possible education and narrow it down. I'd like my kids to understand that I don't have all the facts, and I need to find out. I want my kids to be broader. I want my kids to taste what's out there. I want my kids to understand how ignorant they are. Now, ignorant isn't stupid. You know the difference? Stupid means you lack intelligence. You're dull-witted, okay? Ignorant means you lack facts. You lack information. An ignorant person is someone who doesn't know all the facts. A stupid person is a person who isn't able to put the facts together even if you give them on a plate in front of them, okay? So to say that someone is ignorant is not a slur. It's not saying that this person lacks intelligence. It's saying they simply lack facts. And the place to start when you want to grow and become broader is to recognize how ignorant you are. This is a place where, used properly, television is a great tool. It always makes me amazed at how ignorant I am of things. Not like watching Jeopardy, you know, somebody being able to tell me, you know, the gross national product of Toowoomba in 1924. That's not what I mean by ignorant of facts. But you just look around and you see how much there is to know in every field. The science programs and the history programs and the various things, and you realize, how little do I know? If you look a little deeper, you realize, you know, I don't understand the art of dancing, ballet, music, theater, painting. I don't understand the arts. I really don't. And it makes me feel small because of it. And a good education says, I want you to understand how ignorant you are and to understand you don't have all the puzzle pieces. That's a real problem sometimes for our movement. We've got the truth. We've got the answers, but we don't have all the facts. It's different. You know, I know what the truth is. It's here. Whether I understand it and can see it all and put it all together is another matter. I've got the absolute truth in a hunky-dory brain. You know, my brain can't put it all together, but I got the truth here. But what I don't have are the facts. How does that apply? How does that work? What's the truth about these people? How can I answer that? I don't even have to go to other cultures, right in this area. I don't know what the facts in your family and your background and your problem are. I have the truth, but I don't have the facts. Prejudice comes when people don't know that they lack the facts and don't care that they lack the facts. It doesn't dawn on them that there might be another side to things. Just an example. How many of you know that Moses had a black wife? Okay. How many of you know what happened to the person who complained about Moses having a black wife? We don't even talk about that. Moses, okay, as he got older, married, and he married a woman who was black. His sister Miriam complained. Who is going to complain? You know, family members, right? They're going to complain. What did the Lord do to Miriam because she complained about Moses having a black wife? Anybody know? Literally, what did he do? He turned her face white. He turned her face, but it says he turned her face white with leprosy. Now, again, you do know that leprosy in the Bible is not leprosy today? You didn't know that. Leprosy in the Bible was a skin disease, like impetigo, something like that, that was highly, highly contagious and made everything. Leprosy that we have today is not highly contagious. You have to have long and prolonged and constant contact to get leprosy from someone. What we call leprosy today was not what the Bible called leprosy. They're two different diseases. And it was a skin disease that flaked all your skin and it turned your skin white as the skin dried up and fell off your body. And so when she complained that Moses married a black woman, God turned her face white. Interesting. Isn't it how, well, what's the point? We should all go out and find somebody to marry who's a different color? That's not the point I'm trying to make. I'm just trying to say that we don't even know what our own Bible says about these things. And we haven't put everything together. And the place to start is to recognize that what motivates prejudice is ignorance and not knowing that we're ignorant. And I think that we've got to start and look at our hearts and say, now, prejudice starts because we're politically oriented. We're worried about power and not about doing what's right. We're worried about protecting our turf. We feel threatened and we want to protect it from inroads instead of saying what's right and what's wrong. I don't know if you ever find it. Sometimes I'm listening to a debate on TV, but I'm only listening to one side. I want my side to make points. And I got to learn to listen and not feel threatened and say, now, maybe the other side is saying something that I need to hear. Maybe they're talking about things that I need to talk about. Maybe they have a concern for things that I need to be concerned about. It comes from being politically oriented, wanting power. It comes from feeling threatened. And it comes from being ignorant, from simply not having in your hands the facts, the things that you need, and not knowing that we're ignorant. We all are. We are all born in a place where we're so busy we've got to focus and we don't have time to take a good look around us. But I think it's a great problem in Christian circles that we get so narrow that we really can't see the world around us as it's supposed to be seen. I don't expect, and I really trust, that you don't go out and pick up false perspectives and views and philosophies. That's not right.